Good afternoon. So, last time... Right. Projecting. So last time we covered loop unrolling and cache blocking and how they were kind of related.
Oh.
Yep. Okay. Covered loop unrolling and cache blocking and how they were kind of related. And we covered a more complex problem of out of order execution and how that affected our optimization. We learned that out of order processors had these queues of waiting instructions, and they had multiple execution units which could execute those instructions potentially in parallel. And the way these queues worked is that every cycle we'd look and say, okay, which of these instructions can we execute now? And which of them, you know, don't we have the operands for? We take a number of the ones we could execute now and put them on whatever execution units we had. And this meant that a way we can improve the performance of programs is by providing more opportunities to run two operations in parallel. And one way of doing this was reassociation. We saw that different orders of operations, taking advantage of things being commutative and associative, like multiplication, different orders of operations exposed more parallelism and would run faster because the processor would take the two things which didn't have dependencies between them and run them at the same time. And we extended this to loops, where the idea for loops, if you have a loop which is accumulating some value, like a sum, we could have multiple accumulators, and this would effectively give us reassociation over the loop iterations. And this allowed us to get more parallelism by reducing those data dependencies and have things execute more quickly. We also talked about how we had shifting bottlenecks. So, for example, with our running example of loop unrolling and multiple accumulators, initially we unrolled the loop until it didn't help anymore. Then we realized, oh, the problem is I have these extra ALUs, but I'm not using them. That's why I can't run any faster. So we fixed that by using multiple accumulators to expose more parallel operations. And after we did that, we discovered that our loop overhead mattered again. And the next optimization step would be to unroll the loop even more, even though it didn't help before. And this sort of phenomenon where an optimization doesn't help until you get rid of some other thing which is keeping your code slow is pretty common. Another example where you might see it is with cache optimizations. The cache optimizations might not matter as long as you're spending all the time you'd be waiting for values to be brought in from memory if you're doing computations, but if you make those computations faster, all of a sudden you actually care about how long it takes memory to give you values. So any questions about what we covered last time? Okay. So our next topic is going to be vector instructions. So modern processors have these registers which hold a vector or a little array of values. So for example, current, like, standard x86-64 processors generally have 256-bit registers and sometimes 512-bit registers. So these 256-bit registers can hold 8 floats, 8 ints, 4 doubles, and so on, because they're that big. They're named YMM0 through YMM15. And the idea is that we have instructions which say we assume this register is holding an array of ints or an array of floats or an array of doubles, and we're going to perform operations on everything that's in that register. And these are called vector instructions, or SIMD for single instruction multiple data, because we have one instruction performed in parallel on multiple pieces of data. And I'll show you what that instructions might look like in a bit. And typically, when a processor implements these instructions, we're going to have basically extra copies of the ALUs that are only accessed by the vector instruction, so we'll actually do the entire operation, all the elements of the vector in parallel physically in the hardware. So I'm going to mostly be talking about these YMM registers. There's also 128-bit versions of everything that we're talking, well, not almost everything we're talking about, and those use registers which are named XMM 0 through 15. And you might guess, based on the pattern, what the 512-bit versions might be named, and so on. So let me show you an example vector instruction. And this is a vector add instruction. So it's a bit different than instructions we've seen. Most notably, we take this YMM register instead of one of our normal registers. It also has three operands. So Intel, having the luxury of designing new instructions, said, gosh, it's really inconvenient to have two operands because I have to move values all the time. I'm going to make these new instructions have three operands. That's the only reason why. They could have had it with two, but they didn't. And we have these 256-bit values, and this instruction ends with this D, which stands for D word or double word. And that's Intel's name for a 32-bit value, because when they made up these names, the standard size of a register was 16 bits, so it's double that size. That's where the name comes from, and that's why the instruction is add D. So this takes these 256-bit vectors and treats them as arrays of 32-bit values. So let's say YMM0, interpreted as 8 ints. So 8 ints contains 1, 2, up to 8. YMM1 contains 9, 10, up to 16. That's the array of values it contains. Then this instruction is going to take each pair of these. So we're going to say 1 plus 9 is 10. That's going to be the first element of our result vector that goes in YMM2. We're going to have 2 plus 10 is 12. 3 plus 11 is 14, and so on. So we're going to do 8 adds in parallel, just pair by pair from the operands. So we're going to take a pair of values from YMM0 and YMM1, add them together, put the result in YMM2. So any questions about what this instruction does? And these arrays are just 256 bits, so there's just 256 bits of stuff in the registers that correspond to that. Questions? Okay, so since we've seen this, let's look at an example of using this. So here I have a function add, which takes two arrays of integers. The restrict keyword is a way of hinting to the compiler that they don't overlap. Sometimes it does something, usually it doesn't. But we have two arrays of integers, A and B, of length 512, which is hard-coded, and we just add B into A. So here's an implementation of this loop with these vector instructions. So what we do is we take some data from A, some data from B, and these instructions here are loading, this is going to be 8 elements of A, this is going to be 8 elements of B. So we load those into a register, and we have this one move instruction, which just loads 256 bits into those registers. And then we use that add instruction I just showed you. So this is YMM1 plus YMM0, store into YMM0. And then we have another move instruction, which moves 8 elements that we computed as the new values for those elements of A back into A to update the array A. Then, the way the compiler compiled this loop is that we have REX, this is the byte offset where we're reading, so we increment it by 32. Remember, 32 equals 8 ints. So we increment, go 8 ints forward each iteration. So this loop is doing 8 adds per iteration with that one instruction. So any questions on this code? Yes?
Did you use syntax similar to that? Because you're not incrementing the i532 because of the size, right? But I'm just thinking, like, ever since that, there's a little point to it, where you're looking at elements we're moving it forward, and then we had the size of element in. We had two things in the reference.
Yes. So the question is, the compiler here, it didn't use, could it have done something like RDI RAX, say, 4 and increment RAX not by 32 but by 8? Absolutely. And the compiler, you know, could use this and this, but the compiler didn't because it's probably slightly faster to not do that. Because there should be more places in the processor should have more ALUs which can compute RDI plus RAX than can compute RDI plus RAX times 4. But yes, that would be a valid alternative here. This is just one example of what code you might see generated. So any questions on, other questions on this? Yeah. So what if there's overflow? So this add instruction, like our normal add instruction, if there's overflow, it just wraps around, and that's how it works. It adds them as separate 32-bit values, so it's not going to be the case that if there's carry bits off the end of one, it's going to go into the other. The hardware will prevent that from happening. So other questions? Okay, so another way of viewing this is pictorially. So we have this move instruction, which we fetch something from B, we fetch something from A, we send them both to this vector add instruction, and we get our little array of added values, which we then store back in A. So, questions? So this is like pictorially what happens. And our typical implementation of this is that we're going to have our ALU for these operations is basically going to be a whole bunch of normal ALUs glued together that will have different lanes representing an element of the array. So each of these will take in one of those pairs of values. And when we dispatch the instruction, we just input all the values from the two vectors, and we get all the values out, and we put them back into a vector register. And this is the usual construction. So to make this work, we've just added a whole lot of hardware in order to be able to compute these almost as fast as if we had just one element, like our normal, you know, add instruction. So this might seem wasteful. Why do we have 4 times as much stuff or 8 times as much stuff? You think we had 64-bit ALUs before. Now we have this massive 256-bit ALU, which probably has about 4 times as much stuff, maybe more, because we have to deal with variable sizes. And doesn't that make our processor like 4 times as big? And the answer is no, because if we think about what's in our processor, we have a lot of stuff which isn't computation. So we have the instruction queue, the reorder buffer, all the instruction fetch logic, the caches, we have all the branch prediction logic. And adding these vector instructions, even if we're making the ALUs massively bigger, that's not actually much of the processor's space. So we have very little extra control logic. If you think about data dependencies for these vector instructions, it's exactly the same as if it were a normal add, just the register names are different. So all the dependency tracking logic is the same. So we don't need to add much to handle it, but we added, four times as much computational capacity. So if a program needs to do a lot of computation and can take advantage of these vector instructions, it's going to run a lot faster without us actually adding that much to the processor. Another sort of motivation is that we've continued to increase how many transistors we can fit on a chip. And one way you could imagine using them is making bigger instruction queues and so on. But this is another pretty simple way of using those extra transistors. You just copy your ALU. It's relatively easy to do. And assuming programs can use these vector instructions, it's going to allow them to run a lot faster, pretty consistently. There are some things, other things we need to change besides the ALUs, which I'm kind of glossing over, like the cache. We have to load 256 bits, but that's also not such a big deal compared to sort of the performance benefit we're getting. So the question is, how does this work with compilers? Happily, that's my next topic. So compilers need to know about these instructions, and it is actually pretty hard for compilers to use these instructions. Sometimes they will figure it out, and they've gotten a lot better over the past decade or so. Like, vector instructions have existed not on machines since like the late 80s, early 90s. There was some. This was a popular supercomputer architecture, but compilers were all, for a long time, pretty miserable at taking advantage of it, and you have to basically do it by hand. They've gotten better, much, much better, but a lot of things make it hard to use vector instructions. So one thing is aliasing. So vector instructions mean we're loading all the values at once, we're changing the order in which we load things. So if aliasing is a concern, the compiler can't use them, because what if we're doing AI plus equals BI, and what if, BI plus one is AI? We have to worry about that when we're the compiler, and that can make it more challenging. Conditionals are a challenge, so I've shown you the instruction is do all adds. What if we sometimes add? Well, then the compiler's gonna have a lot more trouble figuring out how to effectively use these vector instructions. There's also some operations which don't have a vector instruction. For example, Intel doesn't have a vector integer divide instruction. If you want to divide a vector of integers by a value, you don't have a divide instruction, so if the compiler is trying to generate that code, the most obvious thing to do is to take the values out of a vector, move them onto the stack, access each one at a time, do the division, move them back. About shifting? So the question is, shifting? So the question is the question, can we shift with vector instructions? The answer to that is yes. So usually, Intel has remembered to make vector instructions for everything which is relatively simple for ALUs to do. There might be some exceptions. Divide is a notable example where they don't, primarily because the divide instruction is actually pretty complicated to implement for integers. And that's probably why they don't have a vector version of it. Okay. So, as I said, they sometimes figure it out, and it's hard to predict. So here I have two pieces of code, and I looked at what GCC 8.2 and Clang 7.0, basically the latest released versions of these compilers, did for it. And the top one, they generate vector instructions if you supply the appropriate optimization options. The bottom one, with the same options, they don't. Now, I'll give you a bit time to look carefully, since the differences between these two pieces of code are quite subtle. And the problem here isn't that we can't use vector instructions to speed up the bottom piece of code. We absolutely can. For example, we're incrementing going in K, so we're accessing K0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So we could load all this into a vector for 8 at a time and this 8 at a time into a vector and do the multiplication that way. There's a multiply two vectors of 32-bit numbers instructions together, but the compiler just doesn't see it. Presumably it has a bunch of patterns for where it uses vector instructions and it doesn't match. Probably something to do with this B being one value you're accumulating, but there's still ways of dealing with that. The compiler just doesn't know about it. And this is a common frustration, which is why I've been saying they've been getting better, but often you run into cases like this where you change something seemingly inconsequential, and now the compiler doesn't know how to use vector instructions again. Yeah. So the question is the speed difference in vector instructions enough that we would care in practice? And the answer is yes. Because we actually have like extra ALU space, it generally will be the case that the like the vector multiply instruction will run, for doing 8 multiplies, let's say, will run at in about the same speed the multiply two integers instruction will run. So if you're CPU bound and not memory bound, so if you aren't waiting for the cache all the time, then it's basic, if you're doing vectors of 8 values, it's basically an 8x difference. Not quite that much, but pretty close to an 8x difference if you have vectors of 8 values. It's even worse if you're, like, you're say dealing with say 8-bit values, which is common like image manipulation. We have 8 bits to represent each color of the pixel. Then that's vectors of 16 values, and it might be order 16 times faster. So it is often a big enough difference. How often depends exactly what you're doing, depends how many values you can fit in a vector, and how much time you're waiting for the cache, which, you know, if your performance is determined by how fast your memory is, then this won't really matter. But it is a huge difference for many real applications. But not all of them. Other questions? So there's other sorts of weird things that come up. So for example, an older version of Clang will vectorize the top loop, top function, but not the bottom one. And the only difference is the top one has ints here, the bottom one has longs here. This is fixed in later versions, but this is the sort of fun surprises you get with how compilers vectorize things. Just a little bug where they didn't know how to handle long indices, so it just didn't get vectorized. No error message, no warning. Your code's just 8 times slower. So that's what compilers do. And you mentioned the option of, if we're worried about this, we can try to construct our code so the compiler will figure out how to vectorize it. And this is certainly a thing you might do. There are some other options. So one is, obviously, the compiler doesn't do the job, you can do it yourself. So one way is you could just write the assembly by hand. And for important things, people actually do this. Another way is that there are these intrinsic functions. So Intel has defined a bunch of functions for compilers to implement. And the idea is that these look like C functions, but they actually turn into just a particular instruction. They're always like effectively inline and just one instruction. Yeah.
So Intel just dictate things that should be added to the system.
So the question is, does Intel dictate things? So the way this worked is Intel set up this, had their own implementation of these intrinsics in their own compiler, and the other people copied them because they are actually pretty useful. And they wanted to compile those programs. And usually compilers have some way of wrapping an assembly function as a function, because that's handy in lots of other contexts where you might want to use a special instruction. So it wasn't actually hard for the compilers to add these. For example, if you look at GCC's implementation of these, it's a header file which calls some built-in functions that GCC makes to wrap special instructions, which they were doing before Intel was doing this stuff. So I'm going to show you Intel's intrinsics. So it's all Intel's fault that the syntax is pretty bad. So let's go through an example. And I wasn't kidding, the syntax is pretty bad. So let's start with the types here. So we have this type, underscore, underscore, M256i. And this is a type which represents 256 bits of integers. And the idea is if you have a variable of this type, it can be stored in one of those 256-bit registers. There's also other types. So there's a one without the I is for floats, and one with a D instead of the I is for doubles. And this is all 256 bits of floats, 256 bits of doubles, and 256 bits of integers. So they're all the same size. They will be stored in the same registers. Intel just decided to make separate types for the different kinds of values, but didn't want to separate the different sizes of integers for some reason. And note that we also have pointers to these values, which we cast our arrays to say, I want to get 256, a pointer to 256 bits of stuff. I cast my array to that to say, here's 256 bits of stuff to load in this case. We also have these intrinsic functions. And the general pattern is that they're all going to start with underscore mm256. And they're usually going to end with an indicator of the size of value they work with. So these are the load and store functions. So they end with SI256, which stands for a 256-bit integer value. And that indicates the size of the thing being loaded. They also have a U. The U stands for unaligned. So there's a version of these functions without a U. And those require that the pointer you pass to them have an address which is a multiple of 32. This one doesn't. The reason why I don't use it is because if you look at our function, we're just taking in a pointer to an int. We don't know that that's at an address which is a multiple of 32. Could be anywhere in those arrays. And the same is true for the store function. So we also have an add function. So the add function has, you know, the same prefix, underscore mm256 underscore. And it has this postfix, which indicates the type of values it adds. So we have this prefix EPI. P stands for packed integers. PI stands for packed integers. E for extended packed integers, because there was a prior version which had shorter vectors. And they never got rid of this from the name. But it's 32-bit integers, however many fills the vector. So that says this is adding 32-bit integers in these two vectors, which are these values, A values and B values, which we loaded previously. So this turns into that P add, VP add D instruction we saw earlier. Oh, and my comments are wrong. That's what I forgot about this slide. This is adding 8. And 32-bit integers. This is why you don't use comments, so they never go out of date. Okay. So, any questions about this code? So far I've shown you this with 32-bit integers. There's also a 64-bit version. So here I'm using longs, and there's a 64-bit version of the add function. Otherwise, this works the same way. And note, because I'm doing four values at a time instead of eight, I changed this here. This I plus equals 8, which we had in the previous slide, became I plus equals 4. Any questions about this? Yes.
Are the vector values completely separate from the other ALUs? So you want to continue enrolling something that matches those other separate?
So the question is, are the vector ALUs really separate from the other ALUs? I think the answer is no. The answer is definitely no for floating point. I think the answer is no in general. So I believe yes. If you used all the vector instructions, you'll not have ALUs. So you can't like do integer instructions in parallel and get things faster. Okay. So those are these 256-bit vector instructions. So there's also 128-bit versions of everything. And the history is Intel in 1999 introduced these 128-bit vectors, and in 2011 they introduced 256-bit vectors. More recently they've introduced 512-bit. So there's 128-bit versions of a lot of the intrinsic functions I've shown you for 256-bit. So you'd think you'd just replace all the 256 with 128, and that's almost true, but not quite. So indeed, our M256i becomes M128i. Makes sense. Our M256 add EPI 32 becomes, I have an extra underscore. That's something there shouldn't be any underscore here. But the MM256 becomes just MM. Sorry. And then I have an extra underscore in the function names because Intel's convention is hard for me to memorize. And we also have our load. The size of the load was 256, now it's 128. But for the size of the elements of the vector, that's the same. It's still 32-bit values. We just have less of them that fit in our 128-bit vector. And the pattern for 512-bit is probably similar, but doesn't have this weird exception where we omit the size. Questions? Nice. Okay, so we're going to have an assignments after the Thanksgiving break. We're going to have a lab followed by the smooth assignment. We're going to use these intrinsics. For these assignments, these performance assignments, we've disabled compiler vectorization. So playing with your loops to figure out when the vectorizer works and doesn't isn't even an option. You have to do it manually. The goal here is that we want you to understand how vectorization works by doing the process manually. And this is what you do in the real world if either the compiler didn't do the job for you or it vectorized things, but there was a better way of organizing the vector instructions. So questions? So let's work through an example using these vector instructions in something more realistic. So here's a matrix multiply. I have a matrix of integers of size n, and it's defined somewhere else that I'm not showing you. And I just see Cij plus equals Aik plus Bkj. That's what we're doing every iteration. And I want to make this use vector instructions. I'm not doing cache blocking, I'm not doing any storing things in local variables to avoid aliasing problems. This is a simple matrix multiply. And I want to use vector instructions. So the first step I'm going to do is I want to have sets of operations that work on these little arrays. And I know I have 32-bit values and I have 256-bit vectors. So I want to work on groups of 8 values because that's what I'm going to put in my vector register. So I want to get groups of 8 operations that I can do in parallel. So I'm going to want to expose groups of 8 things. And the most common way of doing this is to start by unrolling the loop. So I'm going to unroll the loop so I have 8 iterations of the loop together. And now I have these parallel operations. So here I have a bunch of addition operations that my goal is going to be to do this with one instruction, where I'm going to do all these adds together, and I have a bunch of multiplication operations, and my goal is going to be to do these with one instruction where I do all these multiplies together. And because I unrolled the loop, so we have 8 iterations, I have exactly the size that will fit in my vector register So this is exactly what I'm going to be able to do with one instruction of the types I showed you earlier. So any questions about sort of why I enrolled the loop like this and what our plan is for vectorizing this? Yeah. So does this mean anything we're going to vectorize is going to be a multiple of 8? So in this case, because I'm dealing with unsigned ints, my vectors hold 8 values. If I were dealing with a different size, I'd have a different number than 8.
But I mean, if we're unrolling the loop 8 times, then we only have to iterate 3.
Okay, so the question is, what if n is too small? And what about, your other part of the question is, well, you don't handle the case where n is not a multiple of 8. Yeah, so to do this for real, there's a bunch of code I'm not showing where we have to deal with, if n is not a multiple of 8, we're going to have to do stuff either without vector instructions or using vector instructions with a bunch of special cases to deal with the n to handle that. Happily, on the smooth assignment, we guarantee you to make things a little easier that the sizes are kind of constrained. I don't know if it actually helps that much, but but it's not as bad as it could be. So wouldn't I have a what? So the question is, wouldn't we have a most remainder of 7? Yes, we would have a remainder of at most 7. The issue is that we can't do that with a vector instruction easily. While we can add like 7 value, so our vector instructions, remember, for vector add, for example, we can add 8 values, we can't add 7 values, though we can add 8 values and ignore one of them. But where this becomes problematic is our store instruction. We can write 256 bits, but writing 256 bits minus 32 bits is tricky. And that's what we want to do for the remainder. There are ways of doing that. We're not going to discuss them in this class, most likely. Okay, so now that we have this plan for vectorizing our unrolled loop, where conveniently things are in groups of 8, which is the size of our vectors for 32-bit values, I'm going to do it. And I need some extra instructions to do this, so I'm going to introduce 2 new intrinsic functions that are really helpful to vectorize this. So this first one here is set1 for 32-bit values. And this takes one 32-bit value, one integer, and loads 8 copies of it into a vector. So it makes every element of the vector as an array of 8 values the same as its argument. And there are some instructions to do this. So there's this, for example, a broadcast instruction, which is the main instruction responsible for making this work. Yes? Oh, this is what happens when I port slides from last semester. There are so many places where I just hard-coded numbers. Yes, that is meant to be 256. Yeah, I did this a lot more in the morning, in the 12:30, but apparently I can never read my slides enough to find all the places I didn't change things from when the example was slightly different. And we also need to do a multiply. And based on the add instruction, you probably think, oh, it's going to be 256 underscore add underscore EPI 32. And unfortunately, that's underscore mol underscore EPI 32. It's actually mol low. So that multiplies the 8 pairs of 32-bit values and gives the low 32 bits of the result. There's also a mol underscore EPI 32, which multiplies pairs of 32-bit values and gives you 64-bit results. This discards the high bits. That's why it's called mol low. And yes, I wouldn't have guessed that. But that's going to do the multiply we want, where we take two 32-bit values, get a 32-bit result. So let's look at vectorizing it. So here's our inner loop, and this is what we're going to use vector instructions for. So the first thing we need to worry about is we have these values in memory, and we want to load them into one of our vector registers. And for C, conveniently, these are consecutive in memory. We have great spatial locality, and another benefit of this great spatial locality, besides that we'll have a lot more cache hits, is that since these are right next to each other, we can load these with one instruction. So for C, we can load them. We just take the address of the first thing and say, I want 256 bits right there. Load that into my vector register. That's exactly what I want. If it happened that the indices were not contiguous, we'd have a lot more work. And it would be a lot harder. And generally, if you want to vectorize code or want your compiler to vectorize code, you'll sure make things a lot easier if you can do loads like, have the good spatial locality so they can do loads like this. Or you can do loads like this. And at the end, after we do manipulate this values we load to add to them, we're going to want to store the results back in the array. The store is just the same as the load instruction, but arguments-wise, just after we manipulate our temporary variable. That's going to be one of those vector registers, hopefully. So questions so far? So then we also need to load B. B conveniently, the chunk of B we want in each iteration of this loop is conveniently also has great spatial locality, so we can just load that into a vector directly, just like we did with C. So then we need to multiply each of those elements with B by this one single element of A, and that's where this set one intrinsic is going to come handy. We want to have, alongside all the different elements of B, the same thing from A. So we use this set one instruction to get the vector, which is AIK, 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 just repeated 8 times. So it lines up with the different elements of B we have. So when we do the multiply, we're multiplying the right things. So, make sense? Questions? And finally, we have two more steps. So we already saw that we're storing the result in C. Before we do that, we better modify C by adding to it. Yes?
So we can get those
variables? Yes. I will show you code with variable declarations on the next slide. But those are variables of type underscore underscore M256i that we're hopefully going to be stored in a vector register. So we have our plus equals. We already saw the add EPI 32. That's exactly what we use for that once we have the results of the multiplication. And we already saw our store, so we store that result back in the array. And when we put it all together, this is the code we get. The horribly ugly code because of the bad names of with all the underscores. And as you can see, they're all M256i's. So any questions about this, the procedure, the code I got at the end? No. Okay, so saw our vectorized version here, and you might say, well, it was awfully convenient that you could load contiguous elements from C and B. Maybe that doesn't always happen. What do I do if I need to like rearrange the values a bunch because like they're not in exactly the right order? So there are instructions for doing this. So, and they have lots of names. Sometimes they're called shuffles, sometimes swizzles, sometimes permutes. There's a bunch of names you'll see for these instructions, and you might need some combination of them. And if you can't find instructions like that, you might be able to rearrange on the stack, in the worst possible case, hopefully not. So for example, you know, cases that kind of come up is, let's say we have a vector 1, 2, 3, 4, and we actually want it to be 3, 4, 1, 2. So there are instructions to do that, and I'll show you an example on the next slide. And these are usually what people find the most confusing part of these vector instructions to use. So let's say we have our 1, 2, 3, 4 is our 64-bit values, and I want to get 3, 4, 1, 2. There's an instruction for rearranging 64-bit values, which has the intrinsic function permute 4x64 EPI 64. And it takes the thing to rearrange and an integer which encodes the indices to place everything at. And the way this works is the low bits say what index to put in the first part of the result. So index 2, if we here, this is index 0, 1, 2, 3. So this says index 2 ends up here, ends up in the first part of the result. Index 3 ends up in the second part of the result. Index 0 ends up in the third part of the result, and index 1 ends up in the last part of the result. And this integer encoding, kind of annoying. You might wonder, where does it come from? This is the actual instruction that this intrinsic function uses, has an integer constant parameter, which is exactly that number, which is how they've chosen to let you indicate how you want to rearrange things in vectors. And there's other instructions which are similar to this, and generally you'll need to look up the documentation to figure out exactly how things work. So any questions? Yeah. Oh, so what is this set R? This is setting X to this value as a constant. So I also could have had an array and loaded it from the array.
And so those indices that are that have those types?
Yeah.
Right, those indices are
values? These are indices. So index 0, 1, 2, and 3. So this would be the same as if I had a long array of 1, 2, 3, 4, and loaded it. And those are indices in that array.
Are there some of the different
ways to compute things? The question is, do the different ways of computing things have different speeds? Yes. And Intel's documentation kind of tells you. But most notably, they're usually limited. So for example, this is dealing with 64-bit values. If I want to move 16-bit values around, it turns out you might need to use a combination of stuff, because there's not actually a convenient move 16-bit values around function, as far as I know. Yeah?
You may have already answered this, but it looks like you're bit shifting.
Yes. This is encode. So this whole expression here is one number. This is an integer constant. And the actual instruction for this is something like v perm some suffix dollar sign that constant and ymm zero, something like that. Other questions? And speaking of rearranging values, something I'd like to note, which if you're using these vector instructions will help in understanding why some things are weird, is Intel, when they were designing the 256-bit versions, designed them with 128-bit ones in mind. Since they have to support both, and also because they wanted to allow processors to not have 256-bit wide ALUs. They want it to be possible to implement most of the instructions with 128-bit ALUs, just using them twice in a row. Like basically splitting every 256-bit instruction into two if you don't have the hardware capabilities or don't want to use them. But this means that there's a bunch of instructions which you would think would like move values across both halves of the 256-bit value, you know, where that would make sense, where if you read the, you know, what the intrinsic does in Intel's manual, it will say, nope, doesn't do that. Just works on each 128-bit half independently. That's why. And related to this, you know, and probably one of the reasons why they wanted to split up the instructions this way, is that some of the processors run slower when these 256-bit ALUs are being used. So Intel and possibly other processor manufacturers designed their processors so they could turn off the extra 128 bits of the ALU when they're not being used to save energy. And the way Intel sets their clock speed is based on, you know, the maximum clock speed you can handle, which depends on how much heat you're dissipating. If your processor gets too hot, you have to slow it down to keep it from melting. And Intel's processors try to do this and get like right up to the edge. But this means that when these 256-bit ALUs are on, it uses more heat, they have to lower the clock speeds and uses more energy. It's still faster to use the vector instructions, assuming you're usually using them, but it means that they actually run at slightly slower clock speeds when they're being used because they can turn off the rest. And probably being able to turn off the rest is why they devised these instructions, so you can like do them 128 bits at a time mostly. So they can have the extra 128 bits be a separate thing that they can turn off when it's not being used. So other questions on this? So I've shown you these intrinsic functions and assembly for vector instructions. There are other interfaces out there for using writing programs that use vector instructions. So one example is GCC has a bunch of extensions which look kind of more like normal C code. Notably, since GCC defined them and not some processor manufacturer, they at no point encode instructions that are particular to a particular architecture. So you use plus instead of add, and you know, they have a different syntax, but it's the same sort of idea about explicitly specifying operations. And another big example is GPUs. So GPUs, essentially what they are machines which do lots of vector instructions. And they have fancier vector instructions than like Intel's processors have. And typically we have programming languages for them like CUDA, which look kind of like writing multi-threaded code, but the threads actually turn into one of the lanes, one element of each of the vectors. And to support this, the GPUs support more features of their vector instructions that something like Intel's processors generally don't. So the question is, for GPUs, is this for video? GPUs can do whatever computations you like. They are good at different types of computations than CPUs are, and video is one of the kinds they are good at. But there's lots of things you can compute on a GPU. And a good rule of thumb is if vector instructions are good for it, it's probably good on the GPU. Okay, so vector instructions, so I would note, this is the other slide I forgot to change. So AVX and SSE are pretty limiting. So there are other features in vector instructions which might be helpful. So better conditional handling, which is partially in AVX, partially in the 256-bit vectors that we haven't talked about and that don't exist in Intel's instruction set in some cases. So better conditional handling is an example. So I mentioned that with conditionals, like that's a big challenge. Intel has some features which help out with this. GPUs like do this really well. Like handling, like I want to do different things for different parts of my array. That's something GPUs are good at. With vector and traditional, like simple vector instructions, we don't know how to do that well. Variable length vectors, so I mentioned we have this stuff where we have the values at the end, and that's a challenging thing to deal with. This is something that some vector instruction sets that aren't Intel's are better at dealing with. And also loading and storing non-contiguous values. So I mentioned that if we didn't have it J plus 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, we'd have a lot of trouble getting the values in the right place in the vector. This is something that other instruction sets do that. OK, so that's everything on vector instructions. So questions about that before I move on? OK, so let's talk about another issue with optimization, which is more general advice. So you're optimizing a program. You're not going to be given, here's a function to optimize. You're going to be given a program. And you want to spend your effort where it matters. So if your program is spending 90% of its time reading files, you don't want to unroll the loop and add vector instructions to that 10% of the time where it's doing computation. Because sure, your program is now 5% faster. Congratulations on your week of work. And there are tools for helping you do this. And they're called profilers. So they determine where your program spends time. And the idea is your program spends time there, then save it. That's the place you can save time. If it doesn't spend much time there, well, maybe you could save time, but it won't help you. And an example tool like this on Linux is perf, P-E-R-F. There are other tools for other platforms. I'm going to show you perf. So perf is a sampling profiler. So what it does is it stops your program periodically and takes a look at what's running and records that. So let's go to an example. So let's say I'm worried that, oh, my HTLRS is slow. So I'm going to run perf. So I'm going to run it with this option record. I'm passing F500 says sample 500 times a second. And this call graph option says please record where not only where you stop, but what function called that. So I have a stack trace. And I'm going to run this on a version of HTLRS, which has debugging information in it, which is not the version I gave you, because I wanted to save some disk space for you. And I'm going to run something which is slow. So I'm going to run an infinite loop. And we're just going to record that. And what this is going to do is it's going to let that run, but it's stopping it periodically and sampling what's running, what call, what's running. And it's going to save that to a file when it's done. And you can see that this is actually, took a while, so it says here that it recorded 7,000 samples. And I can look at those samples with the report command. I'll tell you about no children in a second. I'm going to look at a different sample file which has more samples here. Right, I'm going to remember to run the version of perf which works better on my machine. So here is what I get. So it tells me that about 37% of the time, I was in spend expression evaluate, whatever that function is, and that's where you're spending 36% of your time. 18 and 15% of the time, I was in some part of the hash stack implementation that you were using, and so on. And that tells me where I would want to spend my time. So something to note is that I see that we're using HashMap here, but it doesn't tell me what was calling HashMap. And it's just telling me 30% of the time, 18 plus 15% of the time I stopped in HashMap. And what we really care about is the function that called that, because that's what we want to optimize. And we want to take into account, now if a function calls another function, like the whole thing is kind of responsible for that time. And if I don't pass the no children option, I get a report which includes children, which is the time for this function and everything it called. Anytime we stopped when either this was running or something it called was running. So you can see that main here used 100% of the time. because 100% of the time we stopped the program, it was in main, or something main called. So that isn't, but this means, for example, now I learn that, oh, my spanned expression evaluate, whatever that is, that was probably the thing which was calling hash map, and it, if I take that into account, 60% of the time I was stopped either in that or in something it was calling like hash map. And that tells me that's definitely where I would want to optimize to improve my program. Since this took samples, I can get more detail than this, just the function level. So I can look at here by pressing a hotkey, you can look up in the manual, the assembly, where it tells me for each assembly instruction, like for this instruction, 4.4% of the time, that's where we stopped your program. On that instruction, and I have the assembly interleaved with my actual code like this. This is REST code, that's why it looks funny. So questions about profilers? So the main benefit here is I learned where my program is spending its time. So like one observation you can make is maybe I should consider if there's something faster than a hash map I can use for whatever I'm using the hash map for. And it tells me, you know, that, for example, I don't need to worry about loading files being slow or something like that. I know it's in this evaluate function. So that's perf. Okay, so any questions about that? It's not. Okay, so one other little optimization note is about addressing efficiency. So usually, you know, so we talked about common sub-expression elimination earlier, and you noted that, you know, when you have something like this, it looks like we're multiplying I times n and k times n a lot of times, and we could avoid doing that by, you know, caching the multiplication. And we can do a little better than that. So we can, for example, when caching this multiplication, we can just say, oh, I have this bk of j, I'm going to store a pointer to it, and instead of multiplying times n each time, I'm going to increment by n. And this is, in fact, something a compiler will do. The compiler will do this transformation for you. And that's really nice. And usually it's something you want to happen. So it will eliminate these slow multiplies. So this makes sense. So this is a transformation where we're getting rid of multiplies and instead we're turning them into increments here. Oh, and I have some confusing variable names here. This probably should be a C, this should be a C, and this should be a C. That's the slide I forgot to change. Now, we can talk about this transformation with loop unrolling, let's say. And the compiler might do this sort of thing, where we have an index here, where we want to take the same I times n, and it can do common sub-expression elimination and say, oh, we can just compute this I times n once and add it to these bases I just computed in advance. So that's nice and fast. And it can do that if you increase the number of loop iterations, and that becomes less fast. So what's going to happen here? Where are the A bases going to be stored? The stack. And that's going to can end up being slower. So I'm just mentioning this. So it seems like GCC and Clang sometimes do this. And maybe in those cases, which are not common, but if you're wondering why I add more loop unrolling, why does it suddenly get way slower, this is the sort of thing which might be happening. And if it is, you can check in the assembly, you can find out, oh, things are getting spilled to the stack, and it seems to be the array axis is. And if so, you can fix that by computing things yourself by noting, oh, I can do plus equals n, and so on. You can find some more clever way that the compiler isn't doing computing it. I wouldn't do this until you know it's a problem, because usually what the compiler is doing is great. But if it's not, you can do it by hand, and you might do something more efficient, especially with respect to you knowing that you want to use all the registers not for pointers, which the compiler might not realize. Okay, questions on this idea? Okay, so let's move on to a completely different topic. That's all I have for optimization. So any optimization questions before I move on? Yeah.
I guess, what is the most important takeaway from the factor section?
What's the most important takeaway?
Yeah, that
for an exam? Well, the most important takeaway is probably that we have some assignments you'll need to do with it, and hopefully you'll understand like the sort of procedure you should follow for that.
Right. And we're going to be using intrinsics.
Like, as far as for the exam, the thing I'm most interested in you knowing overall from the course is, like, when are vector instructions useful and when are they not? And, like, we saw, like, things we wanted to be true for vector instructions to be useful, like, we wanted to have groups of the size of the vector, number of values, we wanted them all contiguous in memory, we wanted to be doing the same thing, and those are things that are useful to understand, even if you aren't using the intrinsic specifically, or relying on the compiler figuring out how to use the vector instructions automatically for you. So our next topic is about some exceptions, and I'm going to start by talking about this infinite loop. If I run this infinite loop on a shared department machine, can you still use it? Who thinks yes? Yes, I can. Who thinks no? No, I can't. Okay. What if that machine only had one core? Who thinks, yes, I can still use it? Thinks, no. Okay, so some people think, no. And, well, if you actually run this, you'll discover that you might make the machine a lot slower, but you'll still be able to use it. And we can see why by trying to do some timing. So here, I have an infinite loop, but I do some timing in that loop. So I'm timing this comment here. I'm just gonna record all the times. Not, I guess this is an infinite, and record a large number of times, and look at them. So I ran this on some machine, and here's a graph of the times I got. At the bottom, I have a sample number, and I have the amount of time I measured with a log scale. So usually, I'm getting something like, you know, 20-ish nanoseconds, and sometimes I'm getting like milliseconds. Huge differences. So during these big spikes, what was happening? Any guesses? Yeah.
Context switching.
Context switching, which is?
It's like checking on other
concepts. Yeah, so we're running something else. And this is why if I did this on a shared machine, you could still use it, because my infinite loop would get context switched and something else would run for a couple milliseconds, which is long enough that you still get useful work done. So from my point of view, you know, I get the CPU for certain amounts of time, and I'm running my instructions, and just somehow in between these two get time calls, my machine, you know, it's just normal processor that just sometimes happens to have these million cycle stalls. Still normal processor, still executing all my instructions, it just has some weird speeds. And what's really happening is during that million cycles of what I think is stalling, the processor is actually running some other programs. So maybe SH, Firefox. And somehow the processor switches to those programs. And the processor doesn't actually know how to switch to those programs. So what's really happening is that the operating system runs for a little bit of time and switches to those programs. And the processor knows how to run the operating system. And the mechanism by which the processor runs the operating system is called an exception. So an exception runs the operating system runs and returns from the exception, having arranged to start running the other program. Yes?
So with the timing example that you had, so I know that the CPU clocks have like horizon edges, they have like an amount of time
So the question is, on the CPU, can I get a count of how long has passed? So typically CPUs have a whole bunch of timers that you can read. Notably, Intel has what they call the cycle counter, which is, for example, what the loop lab timing code we gave you uses, which counts actually at a constant rate in real time. And that would be the most notable way you would figure out where time goes. Is that what your answer to your question? So our, as I said, an exception happens. The processor knows how to run our operating system. Next time we'll talk about what that mechanism looks like from a sort of high level, and then it returns from the exception. So what happens here is the OS arranges for that exception to happen. So it starts writing instead of the normal program. Then the OS needs to save some stuff because, well, there's only one processor. And it has some registers, and those registers can only have one value at a time. So it needs to save the values of those registers and also the program counter that it was interrupting. So we can go back to the right location in our infinite loop later and also have the right values for our registers, like for the times we're recording, etc. Then it's going to need to set the registers to the program it's switching to. So earlier on, it saved the values for the program it was switching to, and it saved the program counter for the program it's switching to. And as was mentioned, this is called a context switch. And it's called a context switch because this information that we save for our old program and the information we store for our new program is called a context. So our context includes notably all our register values, including the stack pointer, includes the condition codes, because we better set the condition codes to the right value or else, you know, that next jump might not work, and the program counter. So it's all the state that's visible to the CPU except for memory. Memory we're not going to change. We just have pointers to memory, and we're switching which pointers we have, so that's going to be fine. And we'll actually talk about what we really do with memory later. So this means our context switch looks something like this, that in the OS, we have to save the old PC. Since we are running different code, we need some special way of doing this. Here I'm saying maybe our processor has a special instruction for that. So we save the old PC, we save all the registers, then we load the new registers and the new PC. We jump to the new PC. And sort of pictorially, you might say that on the CPU, we have the registers for one program, which has pointers to its memory. And the OS has stored the program that's going to run next in its memory. And when the context switch happens, the OS simply swaps what it has saved in its memory with what's on the CPU. So now we have process B's stuff on the CPU, and we've saved process A's stuff in memory. So questions? Yeah.
Does this mean that the OS memory for modern computers are massive because they have so many concurrent processes?
So the question is, does this take up a lot of memory for the OS? So how many registers does a program have? So it's like 16. We also have the vector registers if we're using them. But even with all that, like we're talking like less than a couple kilobytes. So unless we're running like 10,000 threads or 100,000 threads, we actually aren't getting to that much memory. This is not what most of the OS's memory ends up being used for, except if you run a huge number of processes, in which case, of course, it is. And we'll have something we'll talk about later called virtual memory, which will have much higher overhead per process. Okay, so, right. And I guess we'll pick up here next time. Okay.